This is a paid message from GoFundMe. Meet Juan Naula. When his son was hospitalized for a viral infection, Juan started a GoFundMe to pay for medical expenses.
It was $5,000 to pay the bill for my son, and I needed only 22 hours. It was amazing. People really trust on GoFundMe.
How did Juan raise $5,000 in less than a day? He posted a short video on GoFundMe, telling his story in 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Be specific, be quick, and tell what are you going to be using the funds for. I was nervous to do it because it doesn't feel okay to ask money, but you shouldn't be nervous. Sometimes you just have to do it and see the results. We were able to save my son's life. Thanks to GoFundMe that we still have my son with us.
Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This message reflects one person's experience.
Moncrief on News Talk.
Traveling around the world by balloon sounds rather genteel, but it's more difficult than you might think. The first non-stop journey around the planet wasn't achieved until the 1990s, and until then it was something of a white whale among balloonists. A new documentary about the first successful attempt was released last week. It's called The Balloonist, and one of the people who feature in it is pilot Brian Jones. Good afternoon, Brian.
Good afternoon, Sean.
There were lots of people trying to break this record, and it seemed like a kind of a thing that millionaires and billionaires wanted to do.
Yeah, that's true, because I think it was mainly because everything had been done in the 20th century in terms of aviation records, landing on the moon, etc. But there was one kind of empty page in the history book, which was flying around the world in a balloon. And of course, balloons were the very first form of flight. And at the end of the 20th century, we didn't seem to be able to get one just to fly around the world.
Yeah. Now, to get one to fly around the world, did it, in terms of how high up it had to go, was that part of the challenge?
It was a part of it, yeah. I mean, the principle is that you need to use the jet stream winds. And the jet stream winds occur sort of around 30,000 feet. And upwards. And so we needed to fly pretty high in order to get them. I mean, it doesn't go all the way around the world in one loop, but they tend to sort of fragment at times. So we were constantly trying to find the best winds we could.
Yeah. And so there is, you know, the traditional view that you're in a basket with a bottle of champagne with you. It wasn't a basket you were in. It was more like a capsule.
It was indeed, and we didn't have any champagne either. So, yeah.
And so, you know, what was inside there? Because presumably, also weight is a factor, did it have to have an air supply? You were that high up.
Yeah. So basically, what we did, we kind of closed the capsule and sealed it at ground level when we took off, and we sort of captured that pressurization inside, and then we just supplemented the air inside with some oxygen and also used filters to take away the carbon dioxide. And we managed to keep that sort of pressure in there. So we didn't need compressors like aeroplanes have and that kind of stuff. And we didn't need to be on oxygen masks. So that was quite important if you're going to be up there for 3 weeks.
Yeah, indeed. Now, it was Bertrand Piccard you were partnering in this. And this was... This was the third attempt. Was it the third attempt by the two of you to do this?
No, it was my first, actually.
Right.
So the pilots changed between the first and third. And I was the backup pilot for the third attempt. I was project manager for the build of the balloon and backup pilot in case anything went wrong. And it didn't go wrong towards the end. And Bertrand fell out with his... nominated pilot and who resigned and I stepped in.
Ah, right. Okay. And did they have something of a falling out about the, something?
They did have something of a falling out. Yes. I think Tony, who the other guy, he wasn't keen on going until the conditions were absolutely perfect. And particularly the technical side, he wanted to understand a bit better. Bertrand was a little more impatient and wanted to get off as soon as the weather allowed.
And was Bertrand's impatience maybe connected to the fact that other people were trying this as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there were I think, six other attempts that year. Richard Branson had taken off 3 months before us and ditched in the Pacific. Andy Elson took off a week before us and was leading the race, if you like.
Ah, right. Okay. And so when you're trying to plan the route what are the variables there? What could have gone wrong?
Well, the route's really tricky because you sort of go where the wind takes you. You can't steer these things. And I think our team on the ground had requested overflight permission for 24 countries that we didn't actually overfly most of the time we were over oceans. But so it was tricky. It was sort of get permissions as you go along and occasionally apologize when you needed to. But it's not easy, that's for sure.
Yeah. And so as a pilot, did there have to be someone piloting the craft at all times?
Yes, there's no autopilot. So one of us had to be physically flying the thing the whole time. Yeah.
Yeah. And so how many pilots were on board and what was your routine there?
Okay. Well, there were two of us. And basically we did 8 hour shifts. So 8 hours we were together in the capsule awake. And then, for the other 16 hours, one or other of us was asleep.
Ah, right. Okay. And of course, you took turns in the bed. What kind of foods did you have on board, given you were on this thing for 3 weeks?
Well, we were fortunate. We were based in Switzerland, and we were quite close to the Nestlé factory, and we talked nicely to them, and they produced some dried food, a bit like space men wear these days. It was just a dried powder in a packet, and you pour on some water and hot water, and then it would magically turn into mashed potato or pasta or something like that. It wasn't terribly exciting, but it kept us going.
Yes, indeed. And I suppose the question, it's not really the elephant in the room, that's the wrong phrase. What did you do if you wanted to have a poo?
Well, we had a loo, and it was relatively private because we had a curtain across it at the back of the capsule. The issue really was that we had a valve underneath our loo, which evacuated it to just into the air. But of course, it was like opening the window in a jetliner, you know, bang, it goes out with a heck of a bang, and it's probably vaporized.
So you had no control over where it was going to go once you dejected it from the capsule.
Well, exactly. But I have to say that we were conscious of where we were flying over. And, so it was into the ocean in the main.
And were there any points at which you started to doubt that you might succeed?
Oh, lots. Yeah. I mean, it was in my mind, I wasn't quite sure that I was doubtful about the thing from the day of takeoff, and it wasn't really until we had a 20-day flight. And it wasn't really until day 18 that we really felt that we had a really good chance to succeed. Because up to then, we'd used an awful lot of our fuel, and we'd had quite a long distance to go. But towards the end, we managed to get into the core of a jet stream wind, and in the last day or so, we were doing over 150 miles an hour.
And at all the time, I assume you had some sort of radio communication. Did you have a ground team of sorts?
We did. We had a control center, which was set up in Geneva Airport, and we could contact them via satellite. It was a little bit crude in that 27 years ago, but it worked okay. But everything was sort of done on a laptop in writing rather than voice comms.
Yeah. And so did you know where you were going to come down? Were you aiming for a particular country or a particular place?
No idea. We just wanted to get across the line that we set on the outbound leg, if you like. So we didn't know. And we were very fortunate, actually, to cross the Sahara, because if we'd come across Northern Europe, either Ireland or the UK, you're looking for a very big field to land in with no power lines, which is not that easy in Europe. So we were lucky to cross Africa again and land in Egypt.
Right. OK. And in Egypt, it was a desert you landed in.
Yes. Yeah. About 200 or 300 miles south of Cairo, right in the middle of the Egyptian desert. Oh. Took them 7 hours to find us.
That's what I was wondering. That was probably the most boring part of it, I suppose, waiting them to turn up. Fascinating story nonetheless, Brian. Thank you so much for speaking with us today. The name of that documentary is The Balloonists. That was Brian Jones there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.